The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hi, everybody. We want to thank our sponsor, Legion M. They are a wonderful company. We love working with them. You can go to their website, Legion M. They're also on all the various socials. They do really fun meetups. You can talk to directors. You can become a part of the projects they choose. They even have a program right now where you can help them find great movies to support. So go to their website to learn more. We also want to remind you that we have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies. Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And you're listening to Maltin on Movies. And today, we're going to interview and perhaps in some cases introduce you to a filmmaker you're going to be hearing more and more about, Isabel Sandoval. She just had a profile on IndieWire that called her essentially the first Filipino female transgender auteur.
Huh.
Are you pleased with that?
Yeah, they're calling me an auteur, so that's never a bad thing. And I'm very, very honored to be referred to as one. And that was actually kind of my intention and goal in making Lingua Franca.
Mm-hmm.
This movie. So the first part I should... My mom's mom lived with us... my whole life. My grandma passed away when I was almost 20. So for virtually 20 years, we had my grandma in the house with 24-hour nursing care. And from that, we got to know this whole Filipino network. And it is a network.
Yes.
And you know, so we, Vicky Pablo was with us the longest. She was with us for almost 12 years. And I learned so much about the culture, but I also got to see the care. And so this movie, just the way it starts in your very opening scene, I started crying because you are comforting this person who is the person you take care of, this elderly woman who's dealing with dementia, and the warmth and the way in which you introduce your relationship is so beautiful. And for any of us who've lived with this in real life, for any of us who've grown up with this especially, it's the truth. It's absolutely the truth.
Thank you.
What do you think it is that has created this network of caregivers? What is it you think in the nature of Filipinx now, is that what? I'm serious. Is that what I should call it? I'm learning. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to learn.
I'm learning as well.
Yeah.
Honest.
What is it in the nature of the women in particular that makes them such nurturers?
The Philippines, you know, as a nation and as a people, have always been, you know, very friendly and hospitable. And I think particularly the women we're just socialized mm-hmm. that way mm-hmm. to be carers and nurturers. And as it so happens, you know, in kind of that global, you know, job market, so to speak, there's a lot of demand for Filipina nurses and caregivers. But it's also, you know, there's a paradox of, you know, Filipinas leaving their own families, their spouses and children to move to a different country, you know, like the US or the UK, to care for another family. And that can be quite set, can be melancholy.
It's bittersweet. It's
exactly.
You're giving up your own family to take care of another, which is the most selfless act. And at the same time, though, incredibly sad. I think, again, for us personally, we're very lucky because Vicky's family lived here. And so we didn't feel quite so much like we were tearing her away. But it is a whole, to say it was such a big part of our lives for so long. And so this story, how did this come for you?
You know, while I'm a Filipina trans woman living in New York City, it's not an autobiographical story, but I do have good friends who have worked as caregivers and home health aides and, you know, have cared for, you know, people with dementia. And I've also Filipino friends who have arranged green card marriages. So the experiences that Olivia has in this film are a composite of real life experiences of either my own friends or Filipinos that I've interviewed in my network. That's why they feel lived in and real, because they did happen.
You do a beautiful job. You really, really do. And you expose yourself quite literally in every way. And that too, you gave yourself. I was going to say you got balls. I don't mean that
but thank you.
You went for it. That's.
I felt like I needed to prove myself in some way. I mean, it is my third feature film, and there's two movies have, you know, premiered and have traveled to some major international film festivals. But this is the first film that I made after my gender transition, and it's my first to be set in and produced in the U.S. And, you know, hear so much about, you know, the industry not really giving opportunities, you know, to people like myself, you know, minorities, first if you're a woman filmmaker or if you're an LGBT filmmaker, Hollywood thinks you can only make a certain type of story and tell it a certain way. And so, you know, I wanted to prove a point that, you know, I'm a talent, so to speak, to be reckoned with both in front of and behind the camera. And it was also, you know, the premise of Lingua Franca is a tricky proposition, because I'm setting up audience expectations a certain way. On paper, it sounds like a social issue drama, and it does touch on immigration and transgender experience, but I'm not the kind of filmmaker that's didactic or preachy. My films tend to be subtle and layered and quiet.
Yes.
And yeah.
The phrase you used before that really spoke to me was lived in. That's a perfect description of your film. It feels not just real, but it feels unforced and honest and candid.
To be honest with you, it could be a documentary. If you didn't tell anyone, that's what it would feel like, is that we're following this woman and the way that she feels. So I didn't tell my husband anything, nothing. Okay. He didn't know. And when the reveal happens that you are a trans person, his tiny mind was blown. He had no idea. And for so for me as a moviegoer, and the way that I feel is that you're a woman. I don't want to have to keep saying you're a trans woman because you're a woman. And
yeah.
To me, I feel that society in general will have evolved when we don't have to say trans woman, when it's just woman. And I hope that as you make more films, and certainly if you're in them, that that does slowly start to fade out, because you're a great actress and there shouldn't be any other, you know, as you said, I don't want you to be a great Filipino actress. I don't want you to be a great trans actress. I just want you to be a great actress.
Thank you.
And, you know?
Yeah. I mean, Lingua Franca is, you know, I mean, the trans movies that have featured transgender characters so far have been made by cisgender, I mean, we call them cisgender men, especially like The Danish Girl with Eddie Redmayne was directed by Tom Hooper. And these type of films tend to pander to the audience in some way. It's kind of like Transgender for Dummies. Or
right.
And almost always the subject of the film is the gender transition process.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm not saying that that's not a valid topic to touch on, but, you know, there's so much more to, mm-hmm. you know, experience. And that's why my movie, Lingua Franca, starts where a lot of these trans narratives tend to end. Like, her transition is behind her.
Yeah.
You don't hear the trans thing being mentioned every 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I just wanted to, like, in the first, you know, part of the film, we were just immersed in her world, you know, of these characters,
right.
Olga and Olivia, and observing them naturalistically, you know, performing their daily rituals, living their lives. And yeah, the trans thing comes up when it tends to come up, when,
right.
you know,
right.
certain men that are nosy and questioning and kind of raise that point, and then it becomes an issue.
Right.
But not before that point, because I, you know, as a trans woman telling this type of story, I want it to feel different.
Yeah.
And I'm lucky in that, you know, there's such a thing called passing.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm lucky in the sense that, you know, when I walk out of the house, I don't have people looking at me, you know, while I'm walking or while I'm in the subway and thinking, oh, is she trans? So it doesn't become... It doesn't come up in the film until it
has to.
With a friend, yeah.
But that too, and without giving anything away, there's a sex scene, and mm-hmm. it's a. And by the way, you saucy minx, you went for it. But you know, there's no point in the sex scene where he realizes. There's not that stereotypical hand goes down, he has a heart attack. You know, it's no. As to say, you're a woman.
Yeah.
For him, you're a woman.
And that has been my experience, actually. I mean, I've said before that it's not autobiographical, but I had found myself in a situation, you know, once or twice where I've become intimate with a man who doesn't know. But so there's, you know, that kind of conflict within me, or where I'm allowing myself to experience that sexual pleasure.
Of course.
Just does in that scene, but also there's kind of a dawning, you know, realization and a certain anxiety over my well-being and my safety.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, for instance, how certain people would react. That was kind of, there's definitely a psychological and emotional truth to how Olivia was you know, experiencing, you know, being intimate with someone like Alex. And it was also, I wanted to do a different kind of love scene because, you know, sex scenes, the way they're shot and edited, tend to be, you know, just shots of naked bodies gyrating against each other. Mm-hmm. And especially when it comes to transgender people who have, you know, taken hormones or had surgery, I think there's a kind, there is a certain fixation or obsession.
Absolutely.
With trans bodies that way. And in that scene, the camera, all, after a certain point, the camera almost never leaves her face. Yeah. Because I want the audience to kind of revel and just observe her enjoying her sexuality. Not an image that I see a lot in American cinema of women owning and celebrating their desire.
We're prudes, is what it is.
We are still a very prudish society.
And when you watch European sex scenes, it is something else, you know.
Yes.
There is none of that. It's the L-shaped sheet that comes, yeah, you know, comes up, covers the woman, and then conveniently goes right below the men's incredibly chiseled abs.
Yeah,
you know.
And I remember when I was very young, I was still in grade school. I hadn't seen the movie at that point, but when Meryl Streep, you know, saw herself naked in the mirror in the bridges of Madison County, that caused such an outrage and controversy. And yeah, but my emphasis with the central scenes here, like that one was the actual love scene, and the first one was kind of the fantasy scene of the reading of the letter, where it starts out Alex is reading a love letter that his grandfather sent his grandmother. And then the scene kind of dissolves into my fantasy scene where I say, you have a voiceover in my local dialect. And it's, you know, pretty much a definition of the trans female gaze.
Mm-hmm. And yet one of the many things that stands out about your film is that it is so non-judgmental. Mm. You allow the audience to think for itself and to make its own decisions, judgments, bring to bear whatever prejudices, if any, they may have, and discover the world that that your character inhabits.
Exactly. And, you know, that's why I feel like, you know, a film like Lingua Franca, you know, being released now, given our, you know, cultural and political moment, can be polarizing and divisive, because, you know, there are some audiences that expect a film like this to be angry, you know,
right.
Mm-hmm. And instead it's patient and thoughtful. I'm not trying to give easy answers to complicated social questions, but I want to ask questions that make people think more deeply and critically about how we live and about a woman like Olivia and her situation. In the climactic scene, where some people think it's ambiguous, or people think that her decision seems really counterintuitive and impractical given her situation as an immigrant without papers. You know, for me, as someone with the same type of background as Olivia, I don't see her deciding any other way. And I think it's at that moment where I'm really inviting people to, you know, regard Olivia as more than just a trans woman, you know, who got involved with a man who doesn't know she's trans, or an immigrant without papers, but to try to put in the emotional legwork to understand how she came to the decision that she did.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, it's all real. It's all very real. How did you get into filmmaking?
So funny. And I feel like we don't choose our passions, but our passions choose us.
Mm-hmm.
Ever since I was a kid, I remember one of my first memories was when my mom took me as a four-year-old to one of those grand movie palaces in my hometown that was built before the Second World War. And that starred the Filipino Charlie Chaplin and his seven-year-old son in some harmless family comedy. And, you know, I feel like my taste in film has just evolved since then. You know, I became exposed to foreign films and classics, art house films. There are not a lot of foreign films that get distributed in the Philippines. So after college, when I moved from Cebu, which is my hometown, which I talk about in the film.
Yes, you do.
Piracy is so rampant that there is a part of the city where you can just go and there's like a mall where they sell all types of pirated. I'm embarrassed to say this, but I was like, how else can I watch movies by Fassbender, you know, Rainer Fassbender, who is an influence on me and also Lingua Franca. Ali Fear Eats the Soul from the 70s.
This is so funny. I have to interrupt you because the image of going to a place, and there's a location here in Los Angeles downtown where you know you can go and get DVDs, bootleg DVDs, and generally what you're getting bootleg DVDs of is Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yes.
Or Con Air, or, you know, the latest Transformers movie. I don't know that you would find Fassbender films.
Yeah, I mean, I saw movies by Ozu, you know, Tokyo Story, Kurosawa, Ikiru, Rashomon from that mall. So that was my film school. I did not go to film school. I have an undergraduate degree in psychology and a master's in business. But my film school was just really exposing myself to all kinds of movies that I can get my hands on. And I think, you know, part of me deliberately did not want to go to film school because I feel like you tend to absorb the philosophy and sensibility of the teachers that you study under. And I kind of want to just, you know, be completely free and experiment and dabble in whatever style or genre or aesthetic that I was drawn to. And yeah, I feel like having made Lingua Franca, you know, I made mistakes that I learned from, but I'm also now starting to mature, I think, as a filmmaker and finding my own voice that's independent from and unique from the master filmmakers that I've admired for a while.
And that's exciting.
Yeah.
You know, you're getting to know yourself. And that's the most important journey for any filmmaker.
Exactly. And, you know, I think the biggest thing that I learned having made my three features is, you know, to paraphrase Maya Angelou, people might forget, you know, your plot. People might forget, you know, the characters in your movie, but they will never forget how your film made them feel.
That's right.
Yep.
And yeah, I think I also took some aesthetic and creative risks in Lingua Franca. It's quite muted and reserved. But I wanted to make a film that I could be really proud of and that I could really, that really stayed true to my artistic vision. And I know that some people are going to hate it, some people are going to love it, but I made the film that I wanted to make. And so.
Now, I'm at a slight disadvantage, more than a slight disadvantage, not having seen your previous films.
Oh.
But one of the things that struck me about this one, and you can educate me about what progress you feel you've made, is that it is such a confident movie.
Mm.
it feels very self-assured, and which is why you don't have to move the camera a lot. Which is why you
Thank you for not moving the camera a lot, Isabel. Bless you. Bless you, bless you, bless
you. You trust.
If something is good, it can just sit there. If the dialogue is good, the camera does not need to have ADD. It's all right.
You trust your audience, and you trust your material, so that you trust your camera placement is going to reveal what it ought to, and put the audience's focus where it's supposed to be. And that's something that I admire no end.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of exposition or spoon-feeding audience. Like you said, I let the audience kind of take in the film, decide for themselves what to think, characters and the themes of the film. Lingua franca is, the definition, dictionary definition of lingua franca is bridge language. So between in this film, English would be the lingua franca, but I mean it ironically in the film, in that what is actually most important is what is left unsaid and articulated between the characters. And that also dictated and influenced my visual sensibility for the film. It's quite sparse. And there are a lot of silences and pauses and spaces because I want the audience to kind of lean closer and pay attention. Especially in, I think, the latter third of the film, when there's a certain part where the rhythm and the pacing kind of picks up when Alex's friend finds out that she's transgender, and it feels like it's gonna go into more suspense-ish, territory, and then it slow it down again a lot.
Well, that's where you fool us. You see, as an American audience anyway, you fool us because we're so used to certain tropes or expectations in the way typical, or if I can call them that, typical films would do that, and where you fool us is you don't do that. You keep the same level of tranquility, if that's quite the word, because there's still suspense involved in the story that has to be resolved, but not in a melodramatic way.
Thank you. And in my own experience as a cinephile, I feel like the most affecting films are the ones that take you to an unexpected and surprising place emotionally, that kind of sneaks up on you. And I hope I accomplished that in some way in Lingua Franca.
I love learning the term. I had never heard that term before. Mm-hmm. And so I looked it up and it was like, it's that, you say it's that middle, it's the thing you find to be able to speak to someone. And again, as Americans, we're so spoiled because English tends to be that language for so many people. When you travel, if there's a person who's German and a person who's, I can't even come up with a second place, Russian, and they need to speak, they can speak English to each other. And, and we really, as I say, we're spoiled. We reap the benefits that our language is the one people speak to each other. But that too is just it's a great term.
It's funny though, because I thought it was a lot more common than it actually is, because when the film appeared in Venice and in these other festivals, when a French distributor picked up the film, they changed the title to Brooklyn Secret. Because apparently, movies that are titled New York or Manhattan or Brooklyn do pretty well in France. And to be fair, it actually did pretty well when it opened there last month. Like, we ended up making, I know it's a low bar, but we ended up grossing more than the new Steve Carell movie directed by John Stewart, Irresistible.
Yeah. Hey, man, it works. Whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever happens. And that's so exciting that it's showing and it's out there for the world. And for for our audience, you're going to be showing your film to my dad's students, which is really exciting. And I'm looking forward to them seeing it. And always, you know, these are generally, let's say, 20-ish year olds. It's usually the juniors and seniors who take the class. And I'm fascinated watching them watch movies. And of course, because class can't exist in real life, that aspect is taken away. But still, you know, it's like having a little, it's a peek into someone else's experience. And so I'm excited to hear what the kids think of it and how they react and what works for them. You know, how they feel. Because it is...
I'm excited to see what they say.
It's very emotional.
Yeah.
And there too, it may be interesting the difference of them not sitting in front of, sitting with their peers. Maybe they'd be more willing to give into the emotion.
Yes, being at home on Zoom may in this one instance be an advantage.
Yeah. Well, it's not Tenet by Christopher Nolan, that's for sure.
Man, oh man.
Wow. Now, I have never understood. This is a gender-free question. I've never understood how someone can direct themselves. And yet it's been done dozens and dozens and dozens of times, starting with Charlie Chaplin and Mabel Normand in the silent era, you know, right up to the present day. And yet it remains a mystery to me. I mean, most especially, I have to say, during that very sensual sex scene. I can't help at a moment like that. It takes me out of the movie ever so slightly to think about you having to say, cut.
Yeah, I think in my experience, just because, you know, when I conceive of my film, I have a very, very clear idea of the film that I'm trying to make. And, you know, the roles that I actually, the hats that I wore in the film, you know, the screenwriter, director, editor, main protagonist, and one of the producers are, I think, the key creative roles and hats that I need to wear to make sure that I translate my vision from page to the screen exactly as how I imagined it. And when you think about it, writer directors who, you know, the main protagonists in the scripts by writer directors are kind of alter egos or doubles for the writer director. So yeah, for me, when I acted in the film, it was also kind of to make sure that my performance contributed to the tone and the mood that I'm trying to set for the film. And I thought of it as actually one less person to direct.
Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah.
All I can say in sum is congratulations. It's a very special film for a whole lot of reasons. And it has introduced me and a lot of other people. And when it goes on Netflix this week, it's going to introduce you to a gigantic new audience. And that can only bode well for the future of independent filmmaking and your future as one of its unique voices. So all good wishes.
Thank you so much. And I'm so deeply appreciative of the compliment coming from you, since I read your reviews growing up in the Philippines professional.
Oh my goodness. Oh my, well that's very lovely to hear and very meaningful. Thank you so much.
And I hope that one day we find a bootleg copy of your film in that mall in the Philippines.
Oh,
that will be the full moment when we get there and there's boxes of your movie named Brooklyn Secret just everywhere.
It's been demolished, but I can send you a copy
there you
directly.
Go. Now, are you a social media person? Is there anywhere people can keep up with you in the film?
Yes, I am on Instagram and Twitter, and my handle on both is at Isabel, Isabel, and then the letter V as in Victor, and my last name, Sandoval, Sandoval. So that's at Isabel V. Sandoval.
Perfect. Okay. And that will be, for anyone listening, that will be in the description as well, so you can find her. Thank you so much for your time. And I know you guys will be speaking again for class.
Yeah.
But it's really a pleasure. You made such a beautiful movie, and it deserves everything that's coming. And I'm so excited that Netflix is going to be there to support you, so everybody has a chance to see it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for having me here.
Of course.
You're very welcome. Talk to you on Thursday.
Looking forward to it.
Me too. Today's episode of Malton on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.